Thank you all. So I did my graduate study at Maryland on the East Coast, and then I spent my life on the West Coast, mostly in Arizona. But there was always been something missing because I never passed through the gateway to the West. So I'm happy that I came to St. Louis now, and I can say that I went to the right path. Also, in terms of Yixin's kind introduction, I should point out to you that in the automated planning community, the planner to beat is his planner right now. So the SG plan is the one to beat. So he's being very modest when he says that, he's at any dead end. Let me talk about some things that I've been interested in. And what I'll try to do is make the talk into three parts. The first one third is like a very quick introduction to the state of the art in planning. And then the other two one-thirds are about two directions that I am particularly interested in following right now. So that's how the talk is structured. Before I even go into that, let me point out that my life is sort of split between two different areas. So I always used to do automated planning. And then as a midlife crisis, I decided that I should have two areas, and so I started doing something in databases and data integration. And those of you who are interested in midlife crisis, don't pick databases. They have continual conference deadlines, and so you'll never actually get to sleep. I made a mistake, I think. However, I believe that this is area on information integration. Let me say a couple of words on that because I'm not going to talk about it. Those of you who have connections to that and would like to talk to me after my talk, feel free to talk to me. Here, we are most interested in basically developing middleware and query mediators that can access multiple heterogeneous databases, potentially online, autonomous data sources, and support query processing over them. And that's the kind of thing that we are interested in there. And I won't talk any more about it, but if any of those keywords make sense to you, talk to me afterwards. The other part of my life is automated planning, and that's what I'll talk about today. So this is the cute obligatory picture of any AI talk, which is if you have an agent, what is the agent trying to do? And there's a whole bunch of infrastructure. It has actions, it has perceptions, and so on. But the nice thing is ultimately the only thing that every intelligent agent is trying to figure out is what do I do next? What action do I do next? Ultimately, everything else is in support of figuring out what action to do next. And planning really is figuring out what are the actions that you should do to satisfy some set of goals you have. That's the general problem. So planning involves deciding a course of action to achieve a desired state of affairs. Obviously, based on the kinds of environment you live in, the kinds of actions you have, the kinds of perceptions you have, planning problem can be easier versus harder. But easy is a relative term. In AI, easiest problems are NP complete at least, and in fact, the simplest planning problem winds up being P-space complete, as you'll see. And then the hard ones are really hard. There are even for the kind of planning problems that have been solved and the systems that exist, there have been various types of applications, both from Sublime, such as the various rovers on the Mars were actually using some of the planning technology. to decide their day-to-day operations. That's actually a great example where if they depended upon autonomous teleoperation, they couldn't have gone anywhere, because I'm about, you know, if the rover is in front of a big ditch and about to fall down, it can't just say, I have a ditch in front of me, what do I do? And then send a message, and 8.5 minutes later, 16 minutes later, say, you know, you get a response back saying avoid it, and by that time you're already inside the ditch. So you need, like, obviously onboard planning capabilities. That's how some of the flagship applications. But there's also the more mundane ones of Xerox, for example. In its most of its recent planners, copiers, it actually does paper path planning using planning techniques. So this just, you know, spectrum of applications I was talking about. There are some of the other names. And this one here is reasoning with pathways in biological, in cells and so on. And, you know, you can use some of those techniques for that too. Now, here is a, you know, the fruit fly of automated planning research is Blocks World. And so here is essentially, if you have a bunch of blocks and you want to stack them on top of each other in different configurations, how would you go about writing this as a planning problem? Here are, you basically would have some actions which have preconditions and effects, and, you know, there are languages in which you can write these actions, and the planners should be able to eat up these descriptions and then do, you know, given these sort of actions and an initial state where you know where the blocks are and the final state where you want certain configurations to hold, you need to figure out, how do I sequence these actions such that I'll go from one goal state to another goal state, one initial state to another goal state. Okay, at the simplest, all you need is, you know, you have a state like this, you do an action, you get a new state, you do a different action, you get a different state. So all planning involves is thinking in your head, given the state I am in, if I were to do this action, I'll get here, if I were to do this other action, I'll get here, and can I get to a state where all my goals are true, in which case am I back, you know, just follow the pointers back, and that's my action. So that's planning, at least in this scenario, okay? So the problem, of course, is within this simple language, this, you know, deterministic actions with preconditions and effects, you can express problems which require exponentially long solutions. And part of the ramification of that is, in fact, finding plans is, in the worst case, a piecewise complete problem, even in this kind of scenario. Okay. That brings us to planning research has been around for the longest time in, you know, intro to AI courses probably. If you have taken one, you would have learned about some of the planners and so on. So the big thing that has changed in automated planning is, as I said, you know how to do search. There are multiple ways of actually describing this search. This is a search directly in the space of states. You can do go forward, go backward. You can also do search in the space of plans themselves to modify the plans by adding and removing actions. All of those can be done. The biggest bottleneck for the longest time has been that the largest plans we could solve, that we can put together, were about 5-6 actions long. Okay, this was a little picture from about 1995-1994 time frame, where obviously there were three planners being compared, and you notice the, you know, way all the exponential curves are raising. Obviously this curve was put together by whoever wrote this planner, because theirs is raising somewhat less steeply than other people's curves. Okay, it's ultimately an exponential problem. The question is, what is the size of the problems you are solving? And it is basically small size problems. The thing that has changed in the past decade or so is search control. We have figured out how to control the search of the planners effectively such that we can solve pretty large scale problems. Okay. Now, one thing that you have to understand, in case I haven't made it very clear, is all the input specification just comes in this kind of a language. You don't get any more about the domain other than just the action. So for example, in the blocks world, it turns out that if you just don't mind, if you're not looking for the optimal plans, one thing that you can always do is put all the blocks on the table and then stack them in the configuration you want. Okay, but that is domain specific. That is actually only going to work in blocks world. You know, it doesn't work for some other kinds of domains. And so the question, of course, is when we are designing planners, we are trying to figure out what is the best search control without knowing anything more than the domain physics in general. Okay, that's why part of the problem. And so as I said, the search control has been sort of solved. Not solved, I mean, we have made pretty big improvements there. We now can solve problems like, you know, hundreds of actions in under seconds. And this is, the combinatorics involved are pretty huge. And that's an that's probably the most impressive thing we can talk about that happened in the last decade in, you know, the mainstream automated planning community. Okay. Now, it did not come because of any domain-specific control rules. It came because essentially something that those of you who have done intro to AI would have learned in like the first or second class about how do you develop informed heuristics. You know, heuristics come from problem relaxation. And the question is, what are the ways you can relax this problem and solve the relaxed problem fast enough and use that to solve, you know, to guide the search, okay? And this is the picture that I show in my intro to AI class when I talk about heuristics. And the basic idea is, you know, if you're computing heuristics to guide the search, you can spend more and more time computing the heuristic. And in the perfect heuristic, you would have spent all your time just computing the heuristic. But then if you have the perfect heuristic, the search takes very little time, okay? And then the cheap heuristics can be computed fast, but then they don't actually improve search that much. But the overall thing that you care about is the total amount of time you spend. And one of the interesting things in AI as a community, not just in automated planning, in most combinatorial problems, is where approximately do we think this magical minimum search point occurs? Where exactly in the space of, if you were to think of heuristics in the on the x-axis, in the space of costlier versus cheaper heuristics, where do you think the break-even occurs? And if I were to reconstruct this, the history of planning, what I would say is we used to think that cheap heuristics would work well. You know, things like set difference, the only thing that you would care about is given two different states, you consider this state to be better than this state if it has all but three of the goals missing here, whereas this one has all but four of the goals missing. Okay, that's the only thing that you would think of. But it turns out that's like, for those of you who have done, you know, tile puzzles in your intro to AI courses, that's like counting the number of misplaced tiles. Okay, these are the easy heuristics to think about, but they don't actually do well as well in practice. And in tile world, actually, the kinds of things that work are pattern databases, which are pretty baroque. I mean, if you're actually thinking about a heuristic in terms of pattern databases, it's a huge, large amount of work you do upfront, but then it winds up improving the overall search. And in planning, too, basically an idea similar to that called optimistic projection of achievability using planning graphs wound up breaking the ice, and such that we could do improvement. And to give you an idea of that, let me give you, again, as I said, this part of my talk is to give you like a very quick introduction to where planning as a community is, and then I'll talk about what else we are interested in doing. So if I start from an initial state, and I'm trying to reach the goal state, and what I need is, if you think of the A-star search sort of frameworks, what you need is a distance estimate. How far is this from the goal state? Okay, there is an obviously easy way to compute this. You know, start from this, you know, the initial state, do full search from that state and find where the goal state occurs, and the distance that you have found is the best distance. Obviously, it's a dumb idea because it's a perfect heuristic, but you have done complete search just to solve this. Okay. However, think about the following thing. So you need an approximation to this idea. Think about the following idea where I have a structure here where essentially think of this as all the actions sort of got unioned here. All the states which have PQ true here, PR true, PS true, all of them have gotten basically unioned together. So you have PQ, RS true, okay? So instead of states, you have proposition lists. Instead of actions, you have action lists. And you have another proposition list and so on. This structure is sort of an approximation. It's like an envelope over the higher level upper structure. The interesting thing about this structure is that if, in fact, I do have, let's say, a goal R, literal R, appearing in level 2, it does not mean that I have a plan of length 2 to reach it. However, if R does not occur in this level, then I do know that there is no plan of length 2 to reach it. So knowing lower bounds is just as good, you know, because it's a good lower bound. And so, in fact, this idea is basically an approximate projection where the place where the goal appears will give you a lower bound on the length of the plan that you need to get there. Okay, and furthermore, based on the interactions between, you can do additional interesting improvements on this, and you can also say, for example, the first level where all the goals appear and none of them are marked mutually exclusive is the minimum length you need to get there. Okay, this sort of an approximate reachability, this structure is actually called planning graph structure. And one of the interesting ideas was that what planning graph does is optimistic projection of achievability, and you can use this to drive planners, and that wound up being quite a big deal in planning community. There are, here is another picture. So in the previous case, at least the way I drew it, it looked as if I have to first do this and then convert it into this. Obviously, that's a dumb idea. You can actually convert, you can do this directly, and in fact, you can construct this in polynomial time. That's the reason why this heuristic works. Okay, so if I have something like this, suppose I have an initial state, what I would do is I would basically construct, a planning graph which sort of considers all the actions that can be done, ignoring whether or not they can be done together. Even if there are interactions, I ignore it for a while, and then consider all the things that can I potentially can have optimistically. Then all the other actions I can do after that, and then all the things that I can achieve after that. Okay, so this is an optimistic projection, and then I can actually use this optimistic projection to figure out, as I said, if something is appearing in a level k, then I know that I need something is not appearing in level k, then I know that I need more than k actions to achieve it. Okay, furthermore, if it does appear, say, here, then one of the things, suppose my goal g appears here, not only do I know that I need at least two levels of actions, I can actually use this structure to backtrack on this and say, look, G can be supported by A4, A4 requires K, K can be supported by A1, A1 requires P and M. And that's just a quick backtrack on this structure. And now this is actually a plan, A1 and A4 to get to G. And one of the nice things about this plan is sometimes it could actually select multiple actions per level, okay? And if you count the number of actions, that will give you even better estimate on the number of actions required to reach the goal. Okay, this is called a relaxed plan, because this would have been a plan if in fact actions do not have any negative interactions. Okay, and this idea of relaxed plan winds up being quite useful. You can generalize this idea under a wide variety of conditions to get relaxed plans for different kinds of planning scenarios, and that improved the search quite significantly. Okay, so we actually, with that idea, we could actually solve, and variations of that, we could solve many problems with deterministic actions quite easily. So what do we do next? One of the things that's been happening in planning is that now that we can solve deterministic classical problems, you can add time, you can add resources, you can add non-determinism, you can add stochastic actions with stochastic effects and so on. And to give you an idea, I don't know whether you can see this, the classical planning essentially is this base case where the world is static, the actions are deterministic, world is fully observable, actions are instantaneous. And that winds up being a p-space complete problem, and we have a reasonable, you don't expect to solve it in polynomial time in the worst case, but you are able to push the horizon far enough that you can solve reasonably large problems. And then as you start removing some of these assumptions, you can start getting more and more expressive domain dynamics, okay? And you can start talking about how to support search in these more expressive domains, okay? So we played this game. We have a bunch of papers in this area, and in fact, if you are interested in my my description of how planning graph-based heuristics have actually helped in revolutionizing the search in planning, you may want to look up this article in AI Magazine that came in spring 2007. That's a tutorial article on reachability heuristics based on planning graph. Okay. Plus, we also looked at, for example, some years back I gave this talk on 1001 ways to skin a planning graph for pleasure and profit, and you can skin it for classical planning, metric temporal planning, non-deterministic planning, stochastic planning, whatever you can, and you can keep. And as you go more and more, the basic ideas remain same, but they look quite baroque. Relaxed plans now start looking quite baroque, okay? But that's fine. So this is sort of the segue into my second one-third. So I think that myself, as well as most of the people in planning, have, in general, traditionally considered generating plants under, generating larger and larger plants under increasingly expressive system dynamics. Okay, so you consider classical, once you start solving them of, you know, large size, then you increase the dynamics to have time and you know, resources and stochasticity and so on and so forth. And normally the assumption is that you consider a plan, any feasible plan is as good as any other plan. This seemed reasonable because in fact planning, just finding a feasible plan in the classical case, as I said, is piecewise complete. And so finding a feasible plan was hard enough, so it was reasonable to actually look for it. Okay. However, what I want to argue, and you know, it sort of is segue into the kinds of things I want to talk about today, is that there are other dimensions, obviously, for planning, you know, for thinking about the difficulty of planning problems and making them more useful. One dimension that I will talk about is basically that irrespective of the system dynamics, you might wind up having different types of optimality metrics. Okay, so you can actually, even if you have deterministic dynamics, you know, if you consider this two-dimensional space, much of what's going on is we are always looking for any feasible plan while you increase the system dynamics expressivity. Okay, but within each of these, I can talk about any feasible plan, shortest plan, cheapest in terms of the cost, you know, cumulative cost, highest net benefit. For example, not all goals need to be achieved. Goals might have utilities, actions might have costs, and all I want is like the total utility of goals minus total cost I spent. Okay, and even more here, you actually, when you do this, I somehow combined utilities and costs into the single currency, let's say. But if I have actually multiple objectives, different, you know, there are, you know, you want to reduce the money spent, the gas spent, and so on and so forth, you have a multi-objective optimization problem. Okay, in each of these scenarios, you can have an entire spectrum of optimization problems, and these wind up being quite important for anybody who has a planning problem. They probably have specific kinds of metrics that they're trying to optimize. Okay, and so one area, in fact, as I said, I'll do in the second one-third of my talk that I'll be spending is what we've been doing in supporting what I call partial satisfaction planning, where you are taking any of these dynamics, in particular we mostly looked at deterministic dynamics, and considering a variety of optimality metrics and supporting plan generation in those conditions, under those conditions. And a third dimension, which is actually kind of orthogonal to obviously, you know, for the other two, and probably somewhat more controversial from the planning community, but probably not as controversial for people who have thought of planning problems but outside of automated planning community, is the first problem that you have when you're trying to solve a planning problem is not the search. It is writing the domain down, okay? And if you are NASA, and you're trying to send, you know, two rovers 20 years from now to be on the Mars, you're going to spend a huge number of people to write as good a domain description as possible, probably try to get it verified to the extent possible, and then you can use, you know, planning technology, which, you know, depends on complete models. But if you are like a casual web surfer, and you're doing multiple web services, you wind up seeing that you're going to one service, taking the results from there, you're taking it by hand, pushing it into the input of another service, and you're doing, taking the input output there and putting it into another service. That's planning. You're doing online planning yourself. And why don't you actually just automatically, you know, why don't we support automatic composition of these kinds of web services? It's a classic planning problem. The reason is somebody has to sit down and write down these descriptions, and the way the amortization costs work, individual users are not likely to sit down and write down the services description. Okay, so the general idea is, I mean, I've sort of shown you a spectrum. On one hand is NASA, which would spend all its time trying to make sure that they'll get the right model. On the other hand is a truly casual user who couldn't care less. Probably they may not do it again, so they would rather do it by hand. Okay, and in the spectrum are scenarios where you have basically lesser and lesser complete models. Okay, so the question of course is, what does it mean to do planning when the models are not complete? Now what's interesting is these two essentially are assuming complete models. Here you just assume complete in terms of dynamics of the model, and here you're assuming completeness also in terms of not only the dynamics but what the user wants. When I talk about incompleteness. The incompleteness can be about the dynamics. Incompleteness can be about what the user wants. Okay. In particular, you call up your travel agent and you say, you know, give me a plan to go to, you know, give me a travel ticket to go from place X to place Y. They don't quite know what it is that you're trying to optimize. Okay, so if they haven't talked to you before, right, if you are like a, you know, the chair of the department, they know that money is no issue. You know, put them on the highest first class and then, you know, get them there. And if you are the rest of the people sitting in the back rows, they know that you don't mind hanging around in the airplane and in the airport for days on if you can save $10. Right. So, but the point is, these are two different optimization metrics, and you know, it's like there is the cost of the flight itself and the duration of the flight. These are two different issues. And if you don't know what your user is, what are you going to do? Normally, what travel agents do is they'll give you one cheap plan, one cheap cost one, and one short duration one. What they're doing is they're trying to make up for the fact that they don't know what your requirements are. So, in fact, there's two things in what I just said, which is one, it's not all that surprising to have model incompleteness, either in terms of domain model dynamics itself or in terms of the user's preferences. Okay? And second thing is, when you don't know user's preferences, you may need to actually, for example, in this case, develop diverse set of plans that sort of span the spectrum so that maybe one of them would be likely to be relevant to you. Okay. So In some of the work that I've been doing, that we've been interested in, in fact, I'm mostly haranguing people to do this work rather than doing it myself. Started in TIPLI 2007, I gave a paper. There's in my area now, they have this thing called senior member track. You know, some unkind people call it senile member track, but I got to give a talk in that, and I basically said, we should all be doing model-like planning. And so I'll talk to you about, you know, this idea of what does it mean to support planning when you have, what are the technical challenges in supporting planning when you have incomplete and partially evolving models, okay? So this I'll talk first, and then this, okay? Those are the two thirds that are left. I don't know whether I'm still in the first third or not, but that's okay, what, by the way, just, there is no big clock here. What's the time I should, I know, but what's the time I need to wind down?
Noonish.
What?
Noonish.
Okay. Okay, so, okay, so let's look at the partial satisfaction planning, which was basically, as I said, you know, this idea of taking optimality into account. What I'll try to get you is what we needed to do, what are the kinds of things that you need to do to essentially support these heuristic search planners to take different kinds of optimization into account. Okay, so classical planning essentially, as I said, is traditional planning. Initial state, a set of goals and actions, find a plan that achieves all the goals. Okay, it's a feasibility problem where all goals have to be achieved. If you achieve one less goal, it's not a plan. Okay, on the other hand, partial satisfaction planning, you have goals with different utilities, actions with differing costs, and find a plan with the highest net benefit, which in fact in this particular case what I'm looking at is cumulative utility minus cumulative cost, and that's the thing. Now, best plan may not achieve all the goals. On one hand, this is a cheaper problem because any plan is a plan, right? Not doing anything is a plan. It's feasible, okay? It's just that it has zero utility. But all of you ABDs in particular, Albert dissertation PhD students know, you know, in fact, the good old days of having courses and deadlines was actually easier than not having, right? Just do good work, and you know, and then you can keep doing good work like tomorrow instead of today, and then so in a way, you know, the problems of partial satisfaction planning, you know, you keep posting, you know, the question is how do you pick the set of goals and the actions to support them such that you wind up having the highest net benefit. Okay, now obviously this is a reasonable problem. You can think of scenarios, many scenarios where this winds up being the case. In fact, the Mars rover situation and also things like supporting observations on various satellites, various like the Hubble telescope scheduling, for example, there are more observations that the scientists want to do than there is the number of hours in the day. And so somebody is doing these hard choices of which goals to work on. And the way that was being done until now is some humans pick whose goals get satisfied, such that then it becomes a complete feasibility problem. Okay. So, but then obviously you want to be able to do it more automatically, taking costs and benefits into account. The interesting thing that I want you to understand is when you start looking at PSP planning, it changes the nature of planning from a satisfying to an optimizing one. Okay? Why is this interesting? If you go to library and look under planning, there are tons and tons of books. Even if you remove wedding planning and all those other kinds of planning books, there are still a large number of operations research people working in planning problems. And we don't normally talk to them as much, they don't normally talk to us as much, because operations research people can't think of a world where there's no optimization. Okay? And we keep trying to tell them that, look, you know, our feasible problems themselves are very hard, you have to take, you know, you have to understand us, and they say, what do you mean? Okay? And if you try to, once you start realizing that optimization is as much a part of the deal, right, you actually have much more interesting connections. In fact, I'll show you some of the techniques we use, wind up generalizing these heuristics such that they'll set up an integer programming encoding, relax it to an LP relaxation, use that to drive the underlying planner search. So this sort of opens up more of a dialogue with people. Okay, and until now, the guys who are selecting these objectives to work on are humans, and so you can fire them, but now we'll have actually, hopefully, planners selecting them. Okay, so there is, you know, you can actually talk about, you know, hierarchy of problems even in the context of these net benefit problems. I won't go into it, but I will just say that I will talk about this one where the cost of the actions, cumulative cost of the cumulative utility of the goals minus cumulative cost of the actions is what you're trying to optimize. Why is it hard? Why is it hard at the highest level? If you want to remember two things about this part of the talk, remember the following thing. Goals have two kinds of dependencies. One is cost dependencies. You know, if you're doing this goal, if you're achieving this goal anyway, the residual amount of actions that you have to do to achieve this other goal is too small. Okay? So even though each of these goals in isolation are probably $100 costly in terms of the number of actions required to do them, if you're doing one of them, the other one comes free. This is the, you know, nickel difference sort of a scenario. That's why we wind up drinking this big glass of Coke. But there is a cost dependency, and these dependencies are not given upfront. They are actually emergent because of the way actions wind up indirectly supporting multiple goals together. So you need to figure this out as part of the planning, that if you were to do this, this will actually be cheaper. Okay? The other type of dependencies that the goals have is the utility dependencies. You know, a classic case is having just socks versus having just shoes, versus having both socks and shoes, okay? Or even better, having just left shoe versus having just right shoe versus having both shoes, okay? I don't know how many of you had this thing, but every once in a while you go to a beach and then, you know, your flip-flop, one of them goes into the beach, you know, into the ocean, and then you say, what do I do with the second one? And I throw this, and then the first one comes back, and then you're in sad face, right? It happened to me, I assume it happened to you too. The point is that certain goals are, you know, more or less, they have more or less utility based on their interaction. Sometimes having two cars is not twice the utility of having one car. It's actually probably less than having utility of one car, depending on the parking cost. But normally, the residual marginal utility is much less. Okay? So you need to deal with these utility and cost dependencies as part of the planning to figure out which subset of goals to focus on. Okay, that's the thing that makes it hard. So you, of course, need modeling these utility dependencies. There's a large amount of literature in the preference elicitation and preference modeling community, which we actually can use. The one that we actually use in our work is generalized additive utility dependencies. I'll show you an example of that. And then the more important part is, how do I push some of these heuristic search planners that seem to do so well in my other scenarios, right, to solve these kinds of problems efficiently. Okay, so here is an example of the kind of problems I'm talking about. So you have a rocket in, you know, a plane in one location, and then it needs to take a person and drop them in one location, and then the plane itself has to go to a different location in the end. Okay. Now notice the important part here is having a person, the plane at location 3 is 1,000 units, plane at location 2 is, person at location 2 is 1,000 units. And if you have both plane at location 1 and the person at location 3, you get an extra bonus, which is extra 10 units. Okay? This is normally the way GAI winds up modeling the utility dependencies. So in general, what you wind up doing, I think I had skipped over that, unfortunately. What you wind up doing is, for all your goals, you give, for every subset of the goals, what is the utility that you get, okay? And so if I have the two goals that I've achieved, then I consider each of the subsets of that and add up those numbers. That's how I get the total utility, okay? That's the modeling issue. Now the issue then, of course, is, you know, the actions that I do itself have costs, and I'm assuming that they're all in the same currency, and so I can take the subtract the cost, the utility from the cost, and then I find the best plan. Okay, I still want to do search of the kind that I showed you earlier, you know, start from states and then generate new states and so on. The question is, when do I stop? Where is the best place to stop? Okay, because after all, most plans are feasible. Most, you know, including the empty plan is feasible. It can be executed, but it's not necessarily going to be high quality. Okay, from the heuristics point of view, on one hand, you can do the kind of relaxed plan graph heuristics to handle achievement interactions between the goals costs. Okay, that can actually be easily extended. The kind of things I was talking about of the mutual exclusions wind up taking negative interactions between actions, and that can be extended to support, so you can expand the relaxed plan heuristics to support that sort of direction. But plan quality, anytime you have optimizations, a more interesting direct idea that comes up is, it turns out that most planning problems, at least the bounded horizon versions, can be compiled down into integer programming formulations. Okay, I mean, there are many ways of doing it. You don't need to know the details in this short talk, but the point is, once I have an integer programming formulation, I can write my optimization metric I want as the objective metric. Okay, and then I can either A, solve it, which is actually going to be dumb because IP encodings are pretty hard to solve, or B, find a relaxation of it, LP relaxation of it, use that as a heuristic to guide the search. Okay, so from plan quality point of view, you seem to need this IP sort of encodings. And then this one doesn't take the utility interactions. This one is good in optimization, but doesn't necessarily scale well. So something that, you know, we have developed a variety of ideas, but the one that I'm talking about is an idea that we discussed last week in the planning and the scheduling conference, which is essentially setting up IP encodings. IP encoding such that even if you were to solve that IP encoding, the solution you will get will still be a relaxed solution. That means it would still not solve the problem, okay? And then I will double relax it by doing an LP relaxation of that, okay? And then use that for heuristics. And those of you, you know, one reason to spend your life on the heuristics as against on the search is, when you're designing heuristics, you can be as laid back as you want, in the sense that ultimately the heuristic is only going to guide the search. So you may be interested in things like admissibility of the heuristic, but if you are ignoring some constraints and the final solution you get just from the heuristic is not right, that's okay, because nobody is going to yell at you for that, because the search ultimately has to produce the sound and complete solution, okay? So I can look at relaxations, and so we developed this heuristic called based on linear programming that I will sketch quickly in a minute. And then we made a planner called Bebopper Loop, which is a branch and bound planner based on LP, and also it's a very musical planner. And the approach is basically, as I said, we'll set up a network-based, an IP encoding, which is sort of based on a network flow ideas, to essentially try to find the plan. And then you take the LP relaxation of that, and then you drive the search. Okay. Let me see if I can at least explain this, because this is the most important idea in this one-third, which is, how do I set up this IP encoding? Okay. What we are trying to do is, I will think of this problem, even irrespective of the way it is given, I can automatically compile it down into what's called a multi-valued representation, where essentially I have two variables, in this case, plane variable, whose value can be location 1, location 2, or location 3, and a person variable, which can be location 3, location 2, location 1, or plane itself. Okay, the overall problem might have been given in a different sort of a formalization with Boolean variables, But I would come here automatically. I don't have any hand, you know, there's no human interaction. So having come up with this, now I can think of, for each of these variables, essentially I can think of the transitions that they have themselves, okay? So if you are, if the plane is in location 1, you can get to location 2, and from there you can get to location 3, you can come back to location 1, and so on, okay? So in each fluent itself, you can think of these as fluents, or the, you know, individual features of the problem. For each feature, you actually have a separate transition graph, okay? And what you can do in some sense is, you can set up plans for each of these individual fluents as if they are independent, and then add the interactions between the fluents as extra constraints, okay? Obviously, they are not independent. That's why planning is hard. But we, you know, when we are setting up the heuristics, we can act as if they are independent, and then add the additional penalties for the interactions. So in this particular case, if you're looking here, you know, the basically you'll notice that I set up the domain transition graph, and then I can talk about the cost of the actions for each of them, and I can, for each of the fluents, the place where the originally their current position. So in the plane was in location 1 in the beginning, and person was in the plane in the beginning. Okay? And then this is the goal. Plane should be in location 3, person should be in location 2, and there is a utility for each of these, and there is also a combined utility if I get both of them together. Okay, so then the question, of course, is find a flow through this graph and this graph such that it optimizes the total net benefit, which is the summation of cost, utilities minus cost. And so the kinds of constraints I have to do is things like, you know, if the action executes, then all its effects will actually happen. And if a fact is deleted, so basically flow equality, if a fact is deleted, somebody has to add it back so that the inflow is the same as outflow in each of these transition graphs. And finally, if you have a set of goals achieved, then you get any bonus associated with those particular sets of goals. Okay, these can be set up in, you know, IP encodings. You know, this is just to show that I can set them up as encodings in IP solution in integer programming. Now, the important thing that I want you to understand is, even if I were to solve this IP encoding, and then, you know, I have an objective function which is this optimize this net benefit, and then the important thing is, even if I were to solve this IP problem completely, what I get would be a plan that sort of takes some of the negative interactions into account, but is actually not executable because you ignore the action orderings. So it's not a plan still, but it's a different kind of relaxation than the kind of one that we did earlier in the relaxed planning graphs, where we completely ignored anything negative, any deletes, for example, one action deleting what the other action needs. Okay. And then, so in the branch, in the search itself, we wind up doing a branch and bound search, and then we can use the LP relaxation of that IP encoding to compute the relaxed plan, which pushes the planner forward. To give you an idea there, suppose if I were to solve this problem, you know, the IP encoding of that and the LP relaxation of it, you will wind up seeing, you know, if you consider the values of the variables above a certain threshold and say those are actually ones, even though they are not ones, they are going to be fractional, then those are the pieces of the plan that you think are actually really part of the final solution. So what you do when you set up a relaxed planning graph, and when you are computing the relaxed plan, of the multiple ways this at plane location 3 can be done, I consider the action that actually appears in the LP relaxation. So it turns out relaxed plans are dime a dozen, and if you're looking for feasible plans, you can pick any relaxed plan. But you're looking for optimal plans, then you have to find the optimal relaxed plan. And a dirty secret that I didn't tell you earlier is finding optimal relaxed plan is NP-complete. Okay? So even finding a relaxed plan that ignores all the negative interactions, but it is optimal in terms of the number of actions, is NP-complete. So we just find any relaxed plan and we get by. But now that we actually care about the quality, we want to bias the relaxed plan extraction such that the parts that appear in the global analysis that was done by IP encoding followed by LP relaxation wind up getting more of the input. Okay? So that's what I wind up doing. And then once I have the relaxed plan, I can, you know, do all the things that other planners do, which is basically, for example, use this to compute the distance, or also sometimes try and execute as many of the actions as possible from that relaxed plan, and then go to the next plateau and then do this whole heuristic analysis again. This basically shows that as of last week, since Yixin hasn't yet started working on this problem, we are still doing, compared to the various types of heuristics for solving this problem, several of which were actually ours, we're still doing better. And I think in general, this direction of computing heuristics, I think, is quite interesting, even more than what these results show, because of the following thing. It turns out that once I think of setup of the heuristic in terms of the LP relaxation, I have this variety of ideas, such as improving encoding, such that its LP relaxation is closer to its actual IP solution. And this is called strengthening of encodings in OR community. If you're in the CSP community, it's basically adding constraints, propagated constraints, such that you can get a better bound. And one particular type of and in IP community, they talk about this as basically valid inequalities that are added to the encoding. Valid inequalities that we found very useful is this idea of not assuming too much independence between fluents. Okay, earlier, in fact, this is a different example, unfortunately, but earlier we assumed person and location were completely, person and plane were completely independent fluents. But you could start basically merging some of the fluents that have too many dependencies, okay? And then when you merge them, then you have reduced number of fluents but increased size of their domain transition graphs, okay? But it turns out that this can wind up being a winning idea. So for example, in this case, this was a slightly different logistics problem where, are you taking a package on a truck from one place to another, and then if you do basically completely independent, if you have these two, truck one and package one fluents being independent, if you do the LP solution, you get the bound to be two, but it turns out actually that you require four actions for that case. Okay, so two is too low a bound for the real value. Whereas had I actually just happened to combine these two and, compose those two variables into a super variable, you would get a bigger domain transition graph in which actually the LP solution winds up having four, which in this case is actually the optimal value. Okay. Now, of course, you don't get this for free. If you actually combine all the fluents, then you will get the entire state space. So you die, because state space is obviously exponential in the size of the fluents. Okay. But if you do it right, if you wind up combining those fluents that have causal interactions more, then you can actually win quite big. And there was a second paper at ICAPS where we talked about how to extend these heuristics, and we haven't yet used it for the net benefit problem. But I think these kinds of things can be done, and that's a good way of pushing these heuristics. Okay, and we won some competition last year. And then the other thing that I want to tell you is partial satisfaction planning is actually quite useful. I already told you that, Albert dissertation itself is a partial satisfaction planning, and you don't need any more practical problems. But we are interested in a project with a bunch of universities on human-robot interaction in a rescue scenario, okay? And one of the issues is how do you assign tasks with different potentially incompatible goals to robots such that the robots would pursue them and the humans would interact with them. This is just starting, okay? But it was very easy to see that planning has to be partial satisfaction planning here. Goals will have differing utilities, and the new goals may wind up actually having higher utility that you would abandon some of the previous goals, okay? And so that's something that we are pursuing right now, and it's an interesting direction. Okay, so PSP summary is that these are ubiquitous problems, and in fact, you can extend the kinds of heuristics that have pushed the class, deterministic planning search to actually do these kinds of problems quite well, and there are interesting directions in terms of using IP encodings and adding valid inequalities. And also, the other thing that's actually, and this is a good segue into my last part, is that when you wind up picking these, especially in this kind of a human-robot interaction scenario, if the automated planner winds up picking certain objectives and decides to work on them, okay, the first thing it needs to be ready to is having people whose objectives that were not selected calling it up, just like the NSF program managers get selected, you know, calls saying, why was my great proposal not selected? Or you call your conference chairs and so on. So the question is, you need to explain. You need to provide some reasonable explanation. Of course, one reasonable explanation is you are dumb and other people are smarter. But you want a better explanation. And what's interesting is, explaining why certain objectives are selected in a mixed initiative scenarios is a pretty technically challenging problem, because providing explanations of optimality is harder than providing explanations of correctness. Correctness is a local property, optimality is a global property. Okay, so that's something that we are looking at. Okay, so I told you that we as a planning community are very interested in traditional planning, interested in like feasible plans with increasingly more, increasingly expressive domain dynamics. And I said there is this other dimension that is equally important, which is keeping whatever dynamics and considering different varieties of optimization metrics. And I looked at, told you some of the work in that direction. And then I want to end with this other point, which is that in fact, many a time, models are not available. Models in terms of both the underlying system dynamics and in terms of the user's preferences are not available. And if they're not available, what should we be doing in terms of solving those kinds of problems? Okay, this part is probably more in the making, because I'm basically trying to push people to do work in that. We have some ideas too, but I think I just want to convince you that there are interesting technical problems there. So the, and I call this model light planning, LITE, the point is that you cannot, you know, the assumption that the underlying assumption in planning community has been that you can get more and more applications if you can deal with more and more expressive domain dynamics. Okay, but that's not, I'm not necessarily saying that's wrong, but that's not the only way to have an impact on the world. Another one is that many scenarios where domain modeling is in fact the biggest obstacle. Workflow composition, workflow management, many workflows are provided with little information about underlying causal models. Somebody tells you this is the workflow for doing something. Okay, you have no clue as to why the fourth action should be the fourth action. You don't know why second action follows the first action. You're just told. Okay, now why is this a problem? If you are a planner, in any of the plans I talked about, if I remove an action, my planner can tell exactly what goes wrong with the plan. Okay, it may be that it's not a big deal, it may be that it's a catastrophic deal. In a workflow kind of a scenario, if I don't know anything about my plan, then I have to assume that every change is catastrophic, right? Or be foolishly optimistic and say, I just hope that, you know. So the point is, you know, you have no, you know, workflow management is going normally from zero models as we go on. In fact, people who have been looking at that problem are considering increasingly more sophisticated models, but some models that are nowhere near as complete as the kinds of things I talked to you about. Okay, web services, I've already told you, you know, users are not likely to go and write down these very large specifications. In fact, we did studies of public domain web services a couple of years back, and it came up in Sigmod Record, and essentially most web services have bad English descriptions. That's it. There is no formal description in terms of your favorite language. It's just bad English description, okay? And so you have to deal with it. Of course, you can say, let's wait until everybody figures out how to write things in proper formal process. And there is actually, there is a an interesting analogy here. Database community, which I spend half of my life in nowadays, essentially could have said, look, everything worth doing, people will realize that they have to put it in structured form, have to have a nice schema, so that they will realize the importance of the efficient services that are provided by relational database management services. Okay, so they could be waiting here, but then Google's of the world, which can deal with basically completely unformatted, you know, unstructured data, and are providing essentially solutions which have no semantics in any sense whatsoever. Okay, in fact, relevance is completely determined in terms of this unknown metric called whatever it is that the user was interested in. Okay, and then, so if you pick the right type of users, you can win always. But the point is, they're making billions, and you cannot let them, you cannot say everything important will ultimately come to a fully structured world. And as a community, database people woke up and said, hey, wow, this is, we have to deal with the entire spectrum of approaches, you know, the total no structure to full structure and all the points in between. And all I'm saying essentially is for planning too, you need to do that, which is basically consider full models here, no models here, right? You need to consider the spectrum of points in between, and I can at least think of two qualitatively different ones. One is shallow models, where all you know is the input-output types of the different actions. And you cannot actually compute the correctness of a plan in that case. All you can do is, I am generating a string of type this, you require a string of type this, so maybe we can marry. And then you hope that somebody is in the loop, human is in the loop, who says, are you crazy? And then remove that. Okay? But when you have humans in the loop, you can deal with these kinds of models, shallow models, but then you don't want to keep giving junk compositions to the user. The more you can do to cut down the bad compositions, the less work the humans have to do in terms of actually checking their correctness. So if you are doing in this end, and I believe this is an important end, which planning will be very different. It would be about coming up with the model specifications of these inputs and outputs, and you know, you don't have major interaction analysis and so on, but you are actually working hand in hand with a human in the loop in trying to figure out the connection. A different end, which actually, you know, which is more in tune with the rest of the talk today, is approximate models, where even NASA cannot get complete models. You know, they would like to say that they have tried, but they cannot get complete models. And even your travel agent really does not know, when they don't know what you are actually looking for, they have to just, you know, show a couple of plans so that it looks as if they thought about it. In fact, this is a classic point. I mean, anytime you get an interior decorator or a travel agent or somebody and ask them to do something, and if they give a solution to you, even if it's actually the right solution, you get mad. How dare you think that this is the only thing? I mean, you have to, if you want to get good business, you have to give like four solutions so that there's a choice, okay? And the choice there essentially is being created because you can't guess what the user's preferences are, okay? So in the case of approximate models, the plan, you know, you would wind up having to consider both the question of plan creation, which when there are much, you know, some precondition and effects are missing, or some user preferences information is missing. Okay, so the three types of important research directions there are, of course, planning support for shallow models. I won't go into too much detail for that, but you have to learn the input-output specifications and use the system as a filter for the humans in the loop. Plan creation with approximate domain models, there are interesting technical questions. For example, if you don't know the preferences of the users, you should be able to generate diverse plans which at least span the spectrum of possible space that the users might be interested in. Okay? And so in fact, we had a paper in Ichikai last year about how could you have a planner which has complete domain dynamics but doesn't know what the user wants in terms of the type of plan. So how can you make a planner generate diverse set of plans efficiently? Not a single plan, but a diverse set of plans efficiently. And then the third one, which is actually kind of outside of my area, but I'm getting into it now, is if you have incomplete models, you don't want to live with it. You want to learn from them. You want to improve the model as time went on. And in this case, learning to improve completeness of domain models. This is a fascinating problem in itself from a research point of view, because machine learning currently has been focused pretty much in a majority sense on tabula rasa learning, where there is no prior knowledge. Examples are the only things you have. Millions and millions of examples, and you're trying to figure out, you know, let's say classifications or clusters. Knowledge-based learning is what you wind up needing to do this. You have partial models that sort of biases how to explain and improve your models. Okay? So I believe these three are important directions, and I will end with two slides. I realize that it's too late. I went with two slides just to show you that there are technical problems, some of which we at least started solving. One is generating diverse plans. As I said, even if you have complete domain dynamics, if you don't know what the user's preferences are, you need to talk about a metric of distances between plans, and then with respect to that distance between plans, computing a set of plans rather than a single plan. By the way, this is done in search engines. Okay, so if you go to Google, if you go to Microsoft and type Kanban Party, which is I think the most important query in the world, you will get all my pages. The top 10 pages are all my pages. There are 7 more Kanban parties, believe it or not, in the world. And those guys are unhappy with Microsoft search engine. Okay? And it's basically because you wound up just giving one type of result. If you go to Google, I still come at the top, it's good, but there are 7 other Kanban parties in the top 10 results. Why is it doing? I mean, I have the highest page rank, you know, the other we don't have web pages. The reason it's doing it is because it doesn't know, the search engine doesn't know who is the user. So you have to hedge your bets and you have to have diversity. So in fact, the one secret that nobody tells you about search engines is, it is true that the first result should be the most relevant result to the user. But then the second result and the third result and so on should not only be highly relevant, but also should have the maximum distance from the previous result. So for example, if I have two mirror pages from my home page, I shouldn't give that as a first and second result. It makes no sense. But it's still, you know, individually they are the highest relevant pages, but they are not, residual relevance goes down. And the same thing happens for planning. You need to have a distance metric and make sure that the plans that you wind up generating, the K plans that you wind up generating, are maximally distant. And there are very interesting technical issues in how to change the search such that you can get these kind of diverse plans. And so we had a paper said in Ichikai, and more recently we are actually talking about the fact that in the previous one we generated each of the diverse plans separately. Okay, and more recently we have been considering the fact that even though the plans are diverse, they might wind up having some pieces that are connected. And so, in fact, think in terms of basically, you know, what you're doing in computing the diverse plan set is finding a Pareto set in a unknown dimension, of preferences. And then you can actually think of this as finding a conditional plan, and there's some interesting connections to actually, turns out, stochastic planning, which is a point that I should mention, that even if the underlying dynamics of the domain are deterministic, if you don't know the domain, it's stochastic for you. Okay, I mean, it's actually possible that the world is completely deterministic. If you believe in like a supreme being who knows everything, et cetera, which I am not saying you should, for them it's all deterministic. If you have that complete knowledge, but if you have hidden variables, then in essence, you don't quite know when you do something, whether the effect E1 occurs, E2 occurs. So the interesting point from the domain dynamics point of view is that even for deterministic domains, you have to deal with stochastic planning. So it's all great for stochastic planning people, because in fact that's what planning would wind up becoming. Okay, and then this is we also considered some ideas of learning and planning together, where essentially the domain knowledge itself is uncertain, and then as plans are done and then you execute them, you have to try and improve the quality of your knowledge. Okay. So I end with this again and say that. I tried to tell you what was going on in planning and what's exciting in the last decade or so, and how we are going in the expressiveness side. And I tried to tell you that we should take this also into account, and in fact it's a good direction and it is close. And then I tried to also push for this idea that we should really be looking also very seriously at planning scenarios where you don't have models. Now, oftentimes the papers on that sort of stuff were the flakiest papers in the conferences, and people will throw them out. Information retrieval, for those of you who are young, used to be a backwaters community. Okay, nobody would go to SIGAIR. And in fact, if you go to SIGAIR conference proceedings from 10 years back, you would say, my God, why wasn't I born then, that you could write papers so easily. Any random idea will go in, okay, because nobody was going to the conference. Now try getting a paper in, because there's huge amount of interest, okay? Partly because that the problem they were dealing with was always ill-posed. You had to deal with a user whose preferences you don't know, okay? It's a hard problem, but I believe we can make interesting technical strides, and in fact, it connects us to a bunch of other people who have been looking at web service compositions and workflows, who never had the kind of hang-up that planning people had, that models should be complete. And in fact, they're surprised that we have any background knowledge at all, and then want to use it. So there is an interesting connection point with them. So I'll stop with that, and if you are looking for any related papers, as I said, you can still Google Kampung Party. I'm still the top Kampung Party. Okay, thank you. That's it. Any questions, or you want to go home?
Thank you.
I believe that on the approximate model side, right, it's actually pretty straightforward. As I said, diverse plans are things. So on this end, approximate models. So again, I don't know exactly how to make this distinction. That's why I put this dot thing. But on this side, basically, most of the model is there. Maybe some preconditions are missing, some effects you're not completely sure of. This is a classic case where you can model the domain dynamics in terms of uncertainty. You know, uncertainty that's caused basically because of your own, you know, the fact that you don't know enough about the domain. And also there is uncertainty about what the user wants, preference, users. So for the domain dynamics uncertainty, you can deal with stochastic planning ideas. That makes a lot of sense. And for the user preference uncertainty, you can deal with things like diverse plan generation, okay? But then you can also have, if you have planning and using of the plans and learning from the interactions, then there's this whole entire learning aspect which can learn both the domain dynamics over a period of time and the preferences. By the way, the stuff that I was talking about on approximate models, it's part of this DARPA project on integrated learning. And in fact, much of the work that all these DARPA projects are pushing these days are the kind of learning where you do have background knowledge, as against the ICML papers, which are great, but more of them, ICML is the machine learning conference, for those of you who don't know, which most of them tend to be, I have billion examples and basically no background knowledge, okay? And so, in fact, you have oftentimes opposite. You have some background knowledge and few examples, and that's the kind of thing that you wind up needing in the model like planning. Yes, sir?
Is there any role, or do you see any role for statistical approaches to exploring the state space?
Yes, I mean, basically the entire... So for example, there are two different ways in which they come in. Okay, so if you talk about simulated annealing, the search that I talked about for the deterministic planning using relaxed plan heuristics, those are essentially systematic search techniques. But, you know, 3-4 years back, before Eksin won the competition, in fact, Eksin's planner itself uses some of the local search techniques. And then before that, there was this LPG planner, which also used essentially a local search, you know, min conflict based and random restart sort of search technique. So underlying domain dynamics are still deterministic, but the search is stochastic. But then there is a completely different way statistical techniques are very important, which is, in fact, if you have stochastic models of domain dynamics, if the action effects have different probabilities, then, you know, clearly, I mean, in fact, the entire stochastic planning community, you can compile some of them to more deterministic cases and solve them, but there is definitely a very strong connection there. And then there is a different issue, which is that there is an operational model, the normative model, Markov decision processes. You can think of Markov decision processes as general enough to solve pretty much all the problems I talked about. If they can actually consider, you know, the partial satisfaction planning too as a special case. The issue is one of scalability and the issue of one of pushing the search.
Thank you.